Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of mind could imagine an allegory as dark and brilliant as the 1954 classic Lord of the Flies? William Golding was earning his living as a schoolteacher in Salisbury, England, when his breakout work was published. Its extraordinary critical and popular reception catapulted Golding to fame and paved the way for him to write a dozen other novels and three works of nonfiction. But despite his professional success, Golding remained a deeply troubled person, nearly as uncomfortable with his wealth and influence as he had been embittered by class envy as a struggling young schoolmaster. John Carey is Emeritus Merton Professor of English Literature at Oxford University and Chief Book Reviewer for the Sunday Times. He writes about Golding's life and work in his new book, William Golding, The Man Who Wrote Lord of the Flies. John, welcome to Think.
It's good to be with you.
William Golding wrote in his journals that he saw himself as a monster. Did he assume everyone else was as tortured as he was?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think they are or were. Golding was a very tortured man, partly because he examined himself and his motives very carefully and very self-condemningly. I think he realized the cruelty in himself. I think he realized that when he was quite a young man, and it was impressed on him in the war. He had a pretty eventful war. He was at D-Day supporting the Allied landings. He was in a very bloody battle at the end of the war called Walcheren. He killed a lot of people. He was in charge of a particularly lethal kind of craft called a rocket ship, fired 1,000 rocket tubes, 1,000 high-explosive shells at the beach. He had seen a lot of people die, and he knew that, in a sense, he liked it. I mean, he said that he could understand the Nazis because he was like them. Well, I don't think he was like the Nazis, but he saw cruelty in himself.
And I guess that potential for anyone in the right situation to do something absolutely horrific was a theme in a lot of his work.
Absolutely so. And it was, of course, the theme that started him off, as you just said, in Lord of the Flies. He got that, I think, that knowledge, not only from examining himself, from school teaching. You said that he was teaching in Salisbury. That's true. He went back after the war to teach from 1945 right through to 1960 before he gave it up. And he watched the boys. I mean, the boys he taught, some of whom I have spoken to now, elderly men, remember that he would seemingly deliberately stir up contention and animosity between them. He would try and get them actually to fight. They remember he once took them out to a prehistoric earthwork called Figsbury Ring near Salisbury, and he divided them into two groups, attackers and defenders. And he later said that his eyes popped out at what was going on. He had to stop it because someone would have been killed. And he regarded that, he said, as kind of experimental teaching in order to find out what was really inside these young men, what aggression there was, and how quickly you could unlock it.
The other thing that's a theme in his work that I really understood better having read your book was his extraordinary sense of class consciousness. He was not raised with great wealth, but it was something that he really longed for status in his life.
Yes, it started very early. His father was what in England, I suppose, would then have been called lower middle class. That's what Golding called it. He was a teacher at a grammar school, that's to say a school in your terms, a public state school. It was in a town called Marlborough, and that has quite close to Golding's father's school, one of the big public schools, that is, private schools of England, called Marlborough College. So every day Golding had to tolerate seeing these wealthy young aristocrats, wealthy young men, gentlemen, preening themselves around the streets of Marlborough. And he felt desperately envious, he says, felt envy and hatred. And he felt that his own family was looked down on, was disdained by these people. He said the feeling was for him as real as a wound. And he never really got over it, and it was made worse when he went to Oxford. His father was very keen to have the best education he could for his son, sent him to Oxford. It was a terrible mistake, Golding says, because in those days Oxford was only peopled, really, by people from these so-called public, that is, private schools, wealthy young gentlemen. Golding felt that he was looked down on. And indeed, I mentioned in the book that when he had an interview, as everyone did, to try and decide what career he should follow, the interviewer jotted down on his index card that Golding was not quite a gentleman. And that's, you know, he knew that that's how they looked on him.
He somehow lacked that refinement that would have shown him to be a gentleman.
Yes, and his voice was wrong. The accent was wrong.
You know, I reread Lord of the Flies last week in preparation for this interview, and I was struck by the character of Piggy, who clearly is probably the smartest in the bunch, but is of a lower class, you can tell by his speech, and sort of doesn't get to be a leader simply because someone else is sort of in the right place at the right time, and that really speaks to class issues.
Yes, you're absolutely right, and I've heard various people who think that really Piggy was based on Golding's father, intelligent, as you say, lower middle class, and asthmatic. He's not healthy like these other British boys. And it's interesting, I found too, that a lot of people who read that novel tend to identify with Piggy rather than the other characters. In fact, as you know, that novel was rescued from the slush pile by an editor at Faber and Faber called Charles Monteith. Monteith told me that when he first read Lord of the Flies, he read the typescript, he immediately identified with Piggy because he said at school he had been a rather fat boy and wore glasses like Piggy.
Well, I suppose it's very fortunate for the world that Monteith took it because it had been, in fact, as you mentioned, rejected. And it was a very different novel when he picked up the original manuscript.
Yeah, that is important. And I think it hasn't been widely realized. Golding came out of the war. I said that he had a pretty horrendous war in some ways. He came out of it deeply religious. And he had not been religious before the war. As a matter of fact, he had been an atheist at Oxford. Came out deeply religious, and boys whom he taught remember that he would spend hours on his knees in silent prayer in the school chapel. And what he wrote in the original Lord of the Flies, it was called Strangers from Within. Lord of the Flies was not his title. What he wrote was a novel which is indeed a religious novel. In the original version, Simon, the boy who, like Piggy, is eventually killed by the other boys, Simon is a portrait of what Golding said was meant to be a saint, and he has supernatural experiences. He makes contact, communion, with another being on the island, and this being is clearly meant to be God, because he can't be seen. He communicates through Simon's not in his senses, but his spirit. And this whole part is very carefully written as a religious novel by Golding. And Monteith, when he read the typescript, said all of that must go. He wanted a novel which was explicable, he said, in purely rational terms. And I've read the correspondence that went between the two of them in the weeks after Monteith had read it. And gradually, Monteith cut out every bit of the supernatural element of Simon and turned it into a novel which could be, I think, read by an atheist with approval, because it seems to be that religion is something dreamed up by terrified little boys, ignorant, terrified little boys on an island who stick a pig's head on a stick and worship it. So, yeah, the novel was drastically changed by Monteith.
Did Golding resist that kind of change?
Yeah, he did. To start with, he did. Of course, he was very keen to be published. He had written, actually, three novels which were not published in the space between 1947 and 1953. Three novels which I have read, They're still there in manuscript, never published. Sent them to all the publishers he could think of. They'd sent them back. So he was desperate to be published. And just the chance that this firm, Faber and Faber, I mean, the most famous literary publishing firm in England with T.S. Eliot on the board, the chance that they would publish it was something, of course, it was very hard to resist. And he did protest to start with, that Simon, he said to Monteith, used a Greek word. He'd learned Greek in the Navy, and he said, I suppose the novel must have a theophany in it. Theophany in Greek means the showing forth of a god. Well, that exactly, of course, is what Monteith didn't want. That's what he cut out. So Golding did protest, and in fact, as he gradually gave way, all these bits of the novel were cut. It made him physically ill. He said he wrote to Monteith, so he got an enormously high temperature. And I can see why it would have that effect. I mean, on one hand, yes, he wanted to be published. On the other hand, since he'd undergone this religious conversion during the war and written a religious novel, it must have seemed to him that he was betraying his God by agreeing to the novel being turned into something that was quite comfortably read by an atheist.
It's like he sold his soul.
Yeah, exactly. I really think he did feel that. And, you know, the very last novel he was writing when he died, which is called The Double Tongue, is about a priestess at the shrine at Delphi, the oracle at Delphi. And this priestess, her manager, is a figure who is deeply interested in politics, and he wants her to twist her answers to questions at the oracle for his political ends. In other words, to betray the spirit that she believes, the spirit of Apollo, which inhabits her, to betray that religious spirit and make up answers that her manager wants. And she refuses. So I see that as a kind of replay right at the end of his life of the Monteith Golding situation in 1954. This time, the Golding persona, as it were, the priestess, will not give way. She remains faithful to her religious mission. And Golding, I know, did feel that he should have done that. He was lecturing to some students in India only a couple of years before he died, and said, Simon shouldn't have been as he was. I should have stood up to Monteith.
By the end of his life, he said he couldn't bear to go back and read the book. He thought the language was poor. He thought the story was crude and boring. Was he just sort of covering up his feelings of ambivalence for allowing it to be changed?
No, not just that, though I think that is there. What I do feel is that, in a sense, he never got over the fact that that one novel was the only thing of his that sold. I mean, it sold in millions, of course, because it was taken up by high schools and colleges and put on curricula throughout the world. It sold him millions and made him rich. But he wrote marvelous books afterwards. The second novel, called The Inheritors, about Neanderthal man, is a most magnificent poetic novel. The third book, called Pincher Martin, marvelous novel about a sailor marooned on a rock in mid-Atlantic, sort of Promethean figure. He wrote these other novels, went on writing to the end of his life, and never had the same success. So I think he came to resent Lord of the Flies. He joked about the money that he had made. He said it's monopoly money, money in a game. And I think that sort of sour grapes about Lord of the Flies is what influenced him when he said he couldn't bear to read it and it was O-level prose and so on. I don't think he really thought that.
John Carey is my guest. His new book is called William Golding, The Man Who Wrote Lord of the Flies. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Carey. He is Emeritus Merton Professor of English Literature at Oxford University and author of the new book, William Golding, The Man Who Wrote Lord of the Flies. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I was surprised to read, John, given his religious fervor later in life, that, in fact, Golding was not raised in a traditionally religious home in any sense of the word.
Absolutely not. His father was an atheist, scientist, Darwinian, and atheist. He was, as we said, a schoolmaster, a much-loved schoolmaster, actually. Seems to be the most almost saintly man, but he had no religious faith, very militantly an atheist, and he certainly influenced his son right up to the war. Golding was an atheist too, and says that he took every opportunity to mock religion. On the other hand, he loved his father very much and admired him very much, and so he always felt after the war, when he so to speak had found his faith, he felt that his father was really a Christian, only he didn't happen to believe in God. So he was a man of such virtue and much preferable, Golding thought, to many religious people. So there was a sort of conflict in him about his father and a religion which went very deep. And right to the end of his life, he was able to switch into a sort of scientific mode of thinking as well as a religious one. He was very much torn between those two ways of seeing the world. You could say that was the main conflict in his novels.
Well, clearly in The Inheritors, where you have Neanderthals eventually dominated and exterminated by Homo sapiens, he had no problem with evolution.
He had no problem with evolution, but you know, it's interesting, that novel was written twice. He wrote most of his novels 3 or 4 or 5 times. That novel was written twice, and it differed in the two versions. The first time he wrote it, evolution is not something to be, as it were, to be praised or glad about, because these innocent Neanderthals are wiped out by our ancestors, Homo sapiens, who are thinking, intelligent beings, but also evil. What has been destroyed is far more valuable. He rewrote it, as his father might have written it, to make it still the case, of course, the Neanderthals are innocent and are killed, but what develops is something that is going to lead to civilization and progress. And that is shown, if you remember your memory of the novel, that the fact that the Homo sapiens can take their canoe upriver, the waterfall, Golding wrote about the novel, saying how that was a very important symbol of progress. So he havered, as it were, between a religious and a scientific viewpoint, and eventually, yes, it's a novel that is in favor of and illustrates evolution, but to begin with, it was the opposite. It was the novel about the fall of man.
I want to talk about his relationship to his mother. He was very much bothered by a child and also later by nightmares, and yet his mother used to love to tell him ghost stories. What was going on there?
Yeah, his mother is a very complicated figure, I think, and I think actually she is the one who had, as it were, the storytelling gene. I mean, if you look for where the genetic origin of Golding as a writer is, it's certainly not in his a scientific father who got no time for literature at all. His mother, Golding thought of as a kind of frustrated author. She would walk around the house distracted, thinking of stories, thinking of her own imaginations. And, yeah, she used to tell the little boy ghost stories, which petrified him, he says. He was a very, very fearful man as a result, I think, of this treatment as a child. As a man, although, as we've said, he had a brave war record, very courageous, he was terrified of a whole range of things. He was terrified of spiders, terrified of heights, terrified of any kind of insect, even butterflies, terrified of the dark. He said he was terrified of the dark even when the light was on. The very fact that he was alone and it was dark outside sent him scurrying up to Anne, his wife, to lie down beside her and feel safe. He said at night, when he was in the house alone and wanted to open the door of an empty room, he found it an ordeal. He had to do it very noisily to give a kind of warning to any spirits that might be inside. So that the deep superstitious nature was something, I think, that came from the way his mother had continually terrified him, not actually only by telling him stories, but also by pretty violent treatment. He remembers how, when he was very small, I mean, 3 or 4, he was cowering in bed. He had a bad dream. He was terrified of the dark, even then. And he was whimpering, calling for a light. Suddenly the door of the bedroom opened, and there was hurled across the room, a brass candlestick and a candle and a box of matches. The matches hit the wall and flew all over the room. Then the door slammed, and he was left in the dark. That he didn't see his mother again until morning. He cowered under the bedclothes. I think that kind of thing did permanently affect him, permanently affect his view of women, permanently affect his view of the supernatural.
There's many people have observed, including his own wife, that there were not a lot of female characters in his novels.
Yeah, that's right. He wrote for his wife in about 1965, one of the many unpublished works that I've been able to read, which is a autobiography called Men, Women, and Now. And it's an account of his relationships with women right from the beginning, from his grandmother, mother, and so on, and various girlfriends, to try and explain why he finds it hard to write about women. That was the object of it. And I think that one of the reasons he wrote the novel Darkness Visible, some people think his greatest novel, at the end of the 1970s, was because he was able to base it on two women characters, the twin girls who are terrorists, actually. I'm based on women terrorists who are quite common in the 1970s. But he examines their growth and the way they turn to crime with what he thought of as an understanding of women that he had not shown before in the novels.
Is there any question that he was sexually attracted to women and only women?
Oh, no. No, he knew. As we have said, he was deeply self-examining. And when he wrote the novel Rites of Passage, which is, you remember, about a clergyman on a boat going out to Australia in the early 19th century, a clergyman who discovers that he's homosexual, that when he wrote about that in his journal, I should have said perhaps that he kept a journal for 22 years, it's an enormous work, 2.5 million words, and took me 6 months to read. But it was very informative because he talks about the novels and he talks about Rites of Passage, talks about homosexuality, and says that he knows that his unconscious knows that he is attracted to men. He has homosexual dreams, and that though he tells his conscious self, says that he's perfectly normal and heterosexual, his unconscious knows better, and he describes quite a lot of the homosexual dreams that he has. So knitted into that novel is a kind of self-awareness of what he himself was like when he examined his unconscious.
Well, it seems like that amount of inner conflict alone is enough to explain him being miserable for much of his life.
Yes, I think that is true. It's perhaps worth saying that there were events that made him deeply, deeply miserable in midlife. You have said that he was successful in 1954 with Lord of the Flies, became rich and famous, and was rich by the early 1960s. Two things happened in the 1960s which changed his life. One, which might seem trivial but wasn't, I think, is that he got keen on sailing. He bought a couple of boats. First one called Wild Rose, then one called Tenas, big boats which would go across the channel, and indeed he sailed to Norway and Holland and so on with the family for holidays. Anyway, in 1967, he was sailing, well, they were planning to go to Greece and to sail among the islands. 5 o'clock in the morning, Anne was steering, the others were asleep. They were run down in the channel by a Japanese freighter. The boat started to sink. It seemed very like they'd all died, because the freighter just disappeared into the fog. Luckily, amazingly, it turned round. It took about 3/4 of an hour, came back and found them. The boat sank, but they were rescued. That was enormously important to him because of the guilt of risking his family's life, and also because the kind of status he had built up as a naval officer in the war seemed to be shattered. You know, he'd lost his boat and risked his family. That was one thing. And then 2 years later...
And excuse me for interrupting, he never sailed again after that, is that right?
He never sailed again. Mm-hmm. He never sailed again, that's right. And 2 years later, terrible thing, in 1969, his son David, born in 1940, so 29, had a colossal nervous breakdown, had ECT treatment, was forcibly hospitalized, never actually really recovered, totally recovered. And to Golding, it was cataclysmic, appalling. And the journal that I've mentioned is full of anger, resentment, and melancholy and horror. It drove him to a breakdown himself. He became an alcoholic, had to wean himself from alcohol during the 1970s. And there were, 7 years when he didn't light at all as a result of those two tragedies.
My guest is John Carey. His new book is called William Golding, The Man Who Wrote Lord of the Flies. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Let's go on the phones now to Ian in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, afternoon. You do get some interesting guests on your program, don't you?
Thank you. We feel very fortunate, yes.
Yes, I've always rated The Inheritors as Golding's best novel. I was wondering what your speaker would consider his... Bush novel.
First of all, I agree with you about The Inheritors, and so did Golding. That was his favorite. I think that his worst novel is The Paper Men, which he wrote actually just about the time he got the Nobel Prize for Literature. Why it's bad, I think, is because it's based pretty well entirely on resentment. I expect you know it. It's a novel about a famous author, who is pestered and tormented by a man who wants to write his life, to write a biography of him, this academic who he finds going through his trash can to get any spare manuscripts that might give him a clue to what's going on in this great author's mind. So this young academic is tormenting the author, who eventually, we mustn't say what happens, but I mean it has a bloody ending. I think that novel is based on what he really felt. He hated intrusion into his life. I first met him in the early 1980s, and he knew I wanted to write his life and wouldn't have it. He started writing an autobiography to forestall anyone writing his biography. He thought it intrusive. He was a very private man. So this book, The Paper Men, is just written out of that resentment, and it seems to me too raw and personal to succeed.
He writes in his journal, and I'm not going to quote it properly here, unfortunately, I've lost the page, but where he says he really doesn't care about people unless they have sort of a fantastic light around them.
Or spark of light, that's right, you're quite right. He does say things like that, and it's part of, I suppose, the... religious faith, religious sensibility, or something of that kind. I mean, it is much more disdainful, much more scornful than he usually was, but you're right. I think it's true in a sense, because I do believe that his imaginative life was much more important to him than ordinary life. He lived in his imagination. So actually meeting people didn't really matter very much.
So when you would meet him casually, was he someone who was impolite? Was he just dismissive? What was he like?
No, never impolite. But he was never actually there, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd talk to him, you'd get really the standard answers that you knew he'd given many times before. Very hard. I tried once or twice to sort of catch him out by asking him something I thought he didn't expect, and once actually did get something that I was very pleased with. In the novels we've just mentioned, The Rites of Passage and the trilogy about going to Australia, there's a couple of characters who I felt pretty sure were based on Golding's parents. They're quite heroic, free-thinking characters. I'm pretty sure they were based on his mother and father, but I didn't know, and so I was lunching with him one day and said, were they based on your mother and father? And he, almost without thinking, he said, yes, they were. That's what he was thinking of, and I was tremendously pleased by that. But usually, you didn't get very close.
He, later in his life, really, really campaigned hard for knighthood, which is, for Americans who are not familiar with the process, this is something you don't do. You don't lobby on your own behalf.
No. And, I mean, if you'd say, well, is there anything you're ashamed of in the author that you wrote about, I'd say, well, I am ashamed of that for him. But then I think, well, that's a pretty priggish thing for me to say, because, after all, I didn't have that background. I didn't have all that class consciousness built up about the young gentleman at Marlborough College. You know, I hadn't, the class system has changed, and it had changed by the time I was growing up. It's quite bad enough, but it's nothing like as poisonous as it was. So I'm not very surprised that he wanted to rise in the, so to speak, the social system, even though he deeply disapproved of it.
John Carey is my guest. He's Emeritus Merton Professor of English Literature at Oxford University. We're speaking this hour about his new biography, William Golding, The Man Who Wrote Lord of the Flies. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and you're welcome to join us now. You can do that by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Emeritus Merton Professor of English Literature at Oxford University, John Carey. His new book is called William Golding, The Man Who Wrote Lord of the Flies. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, John, a lot of the initial buzz about your book came from this story of an event that happened with a young woman named Dora Spencer. And I wonder if you can talk about what you were able to learn about that, and then also talk about how it may or may not relate to a scene that's in the novel Pincher Martin.
Yes. I changed the name, incidentally. Dora Spencer isn't her real name, it seemed to me. It would be very unfair to some possible children who may still be alive of hers to use the real name. But at any rate, what happened was this. Golding went to Marlborough Grammar School as a pupil of his father, and one of the girls in the class below was this girl I called Dora Spencer, and she admired him a lot. He was a bright boy. He was known to be going to Oxford and so on, and she wanted to be talk to cultured people, and so she cultivated him. And he talks about how one day they walked up to Marlborough Common together. By this time, he was at Oxford in his first year. He was for summer vacation of his first year. So he was 18. She was 15. 15 being, of course, under the age of consent in English law. And he tried to make love to her. They were sitting on a bench on Marlborough Common. And she struggled. I mean, she was willing to go so far, as it were, but no further. And he did want to go further, and she started to cry. As soon as she started to cry, he stopped. He says that he blew her nose, and they walked down the hill again and separated, and that was that. He saw her, as a matter of fact, later, quite a lot. He had quite a torrid affair with her a couple of years later when she was 18, 17, 18, and she had an affair with his brother as well. I mean, she had quite a life. But anyway, he describing that in this work that I mentioned called Men, Women, and Now, written for his wife about his relations with women, describing that, he calls it attempted rape. He says, my unhandy attempt at rape. Well, that it seemed to me that I could have left that out or mention it. It seems, and it seemed to me that it should be mentioned because it relates, not only you mentioned Pincher Martin, where there is an incident that I think picks it up, but even more so in the novel called The Pyramid, where the scene is sort of replayed, though in slightly different ways. So it has a literary significance for him, this scene, this attempted rape, without a doubt. I should have guessed, I suppose, perhaps I did guess, that it would be the thing that all the tabloid papers would pick on, of course, Nobel Prize winner, an attempted rapist, and so on. In fact, my son, who works in New York, emailed me because he had turned up in the American papers. What are you doing? He said, in these papers, in American sort of scandal sheets. It's not the sort of thing I would like the book to be known chiefly for at all. On the other hand, it seems to me that one shouldn't suppress things that are important in an author's life just because they may arouse prurient interest.
Well, what's so interesting about that account, as you tell it, John, is that, and we certainly don't want to minimize sexual violence in any way, but it doesn't sound as if it was as severe at the moment it happened as Golding's memories of it were later.
Yeah, that's true. That is true, and that ties in with what I said about him being self-accusing, self-blaming, self-examining. As a matter of fact, as he tells the story, later on, she does say, I mean, later when she's older and they're having this affair and so on, quite willingly, she does say to him, it's in a pub scene where she gets drunk and says, you tried to rape me. I mean, she uses the word. And although, yeah, it doesn't, as you say, it doesn't sound exactly like what we would call rape, we must remember that, yeah, she was 15. She terribly admired this young man, and he was violent. And so I can see why it might have marked her quite deeply. Actually, it might be worth mentioning another thing he blamed himself for with women was that he was engaged to a girl right through the 1930s, a girl called Molly Evans, and that was her real name. And he broke it off quite suddenly in 1939. I later discovered, since I wrote the book, that actually what happened was he went on holiday to France with her. She paid in 1939, just a few weeks before the outbreak of the Second World War. And she came home alone. Molly's niece told me this and would never talk about him again. And again, something had happened there in his relationship with women that was, to him, shameful. He dreamt of Molly until the end of his life, almost in a couple of years before he died. He was dreaming of finding her dead body and seeing the engagement ring on her finger and so on. So again, he was deeply self-blaming about affairs with women.
Did he have a sense of humor?
Yeah, he did have a sense of humor, but it doesn't come out in the books. That's another thing about reading the journal. I mean, he really is very funny. There's a wonderful scene, I think, when he went to a Faber party. Charles Monteith asked him to Faber party, and he met T.S. Eliot. He was introduced to T.S. Eliot, and there was a cocktail party after the sort of reception, the cocktail party, and someone bumped into Golding, and he spilt champagne down T.S. Eliot's trousers. he says, he leapt back with an agility surprising in one so mummified, which I think is a wonderful line, you know, but you never get that sort of humour in the work, in the fiction, except in one short novel or novella, printed in the volume called The Scorpion God. There's a novella called Clonk Clonk, about, again, a prehistoric tribe, which is ruled by women, and all the men are gay, but the women have to pretend that they're very masculine and macho, and so it's very, very funny about superiority of women to men. Very, very funny. But normally, no, he doesn't get into the fiction.
What was his relationship to money?
His relationship to money?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he liked it a lot because he had been very poor. I mean, early on, before the war, but afterwards as a schoolmaster, they were very, very poor. And their first book he wrote, again, one of these three that was turned down by publishers, called Seahorse, is about a holiday they took after the war. He wanted to give them a sailing holiday, the two children and his wife. Couldn't afford it, so he bought this terrible old lifeboat, which he tried to convert, and he nearly sort of wrecked them. And there's a point in the holiday when they sailed past Freshhaven, some rather smart yachting resort, and all the smart yacht owners were watching them through binoculars and roaring with laughter. And he was furious and humiliated. So money came to mean quite a lot because it meant avoiding that kind of thing.
And he was very, at the end of his life, very bothered by paying taxes.
Yeah, he was. Of course, you must remember that England in those days, the taxes for the wealthy were very, very, very high. I mean, I do put the figures in the book and I can't remember them exactly, but I mean, much higher than any tax rate in England now. All the same, yes, you're quite right. For someone who was a Marxist before the war, hated the super taxpayers and so on, he did change, as no doubt quite a lot of authors who make money do change.
John, you mentioned that he knows himself well and he writes quite candidly, at least in terms of his own perspective, in his journals. Did you have the sense at all that he was writing with any other audience in mind other than himself?
Other than himself?
Yeah. Was he writing to sort of preserve a legacy for his children? Did he imagine that someday these works would be, these journals would be read and used by scholars like you?
I think he did realize that it would be. Because he does write at one point something about how he realizes that an author, professional author, never really writes for himself, always writes for an audience, even though he may pretend that it's private. And he talks about how he fears that when it's printed, whoever is doing the editing will tidy up his spelling and his punctuation, which he's not very good at. He was never good at spelling, and says he wants it left alone because his bad spelling is him. So I think the thing that made me feel not guilty about quoting passages from the private journals was really that I think he knew and expected it to be read.
I did think it was funny. The original draft of Lord of the Flies, Monteith complained that there were more additional commas needed than currants in a fruit loaf.
Absolutely. That's right. And as a matter of fact, that original draft does survive. The manuscript survives. I've actually read it, which is a fantastic experience. And it's quite true. It's commas all over the place.
Was there anything that was excised from the original draft that you thought ought to have remained?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that there was. And one thing that should be made clear is that the great sort of poetic passages in Lord of the Flies, like, for example, Simon's body being swept out to sea, that wonderful passage,
yeah,
those great passages are there almost word for word in the first, the original manuscript. And he wrote those, he did polish them a little, but he wrote those great passages. Monteith did nothing of that sort. He didn't subscribe anything, contribute anything to the novel. All he did was cut stuff out. So, you know, I would have been much more disturbed reading the first draft if I found that Monteith had altered by adding. And he never did. What Monteith added, as a matter of fact, only were the chapter headings, which Golding didn't particularly want, so Monteith made those up. And as I've said, the title, Lord of the Flies, was thought up by an editor in Faber, a man called Adam Pringle, not Monteith.
And they did, Monteith and Golding did have a long working relationship, didn't they?
Right to the end of Golding's life, Monteith outlived him. But Golding is astounding, would send him, again, I've been right through the correspondence, hundreds of letters right up to 1993 when he died. Golding would send him every book with a kind of plea for Monteith to give judgment on it and alter it if he wanted. He sent the manuscript of typescript of Pincher Martin, said, here's this load of old rope, do with it what you like. And, of course, Monteith said it's absolutely ready for publication. He's very wise and didn't alter things if they didn't need it. But Golding, after the Lord of the Flies episode, depended on Monteith implicitly.
Why do you think Lord of the Flies is the only novel title that, for people who are not really into studying literature, why is that the only one we remember?
Well, I do think it's his masterpiece. I think it is a terrifying book. And I think even by seeing the film, Peter Brook's film, which I think is very, very good, that gives the terror of it. So lots of people who haven't even read the book know about that. I think that it is the book which really shows how convinced Golding was of the evil inside everyone, really, and that if you pretend it's not there, then you are deluding yourself. And I think the gradual development, the gradual way in which the plot winds up to horror and is, as it were, saved from horror only at the last moment, is irresistibly exciting.
You mentioned earlier that you and Golding shared the same favorite novel, which was The Inheritors. Can you recommend a couple of other titles if people now want to go back and rediscover him?
You should go back. The Spire. He wrote it, we haven't said that he went to America in 1960-61 and taught at a college called Hollins College in Virginia, loved it, and he wrote The Spire as a result of that. Actually, he was very taken with one of the young women, and she gets into the novel. The Spire is great, and Darkness Visible, which many people think is masterpiece, written in order to fit what had happened to David, his son, into a novel. That's great, too.
So he was dealing, once again, with those events in his life through his writing.
Absolutely, yep.
John Carey is Emeritus Merton Professor of English Literature at Oxford University, and he is Chief Book Reviewer for the Sunday Times. His new book is called William Golding, The Man Who Wrote Lord of the Flies. John, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.